Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Few places love college basketball as much as North Carolina. It's home to the ACC, to the Tar Heels and the Blue Devils, the Demon Deacons and the Wolfpack, Dean and Roy, Jimmy V and Coach K, Michael Jordan and David Thompson, and on to the current generation, Hubert Davis and John Shire. Did I leave out Zion? Oops. Well, you get the idea. It's where March Madness might be too timid when describing this state's passion for college basketball. And this year, it's getting a lot crazier. As of this week, North Carolina is among the states where a bet on college basketball, or any other sport, is now just a tap away on your phone. Maybe you've heard about this.
FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook, is headed to North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, I'm feeling it. FanDuel in North Carolina? Fun is about to begin, everybody.
Hey, guys, ESPN Bet is here. Finally, a sportsbook from your favorite sports brand.
Sports betting is coming to North Carolina on March 11th, but you won't want to wait until then to register on Bet365.
Oh, it's about to be a party in here. BetMGM's got all the sports betting in one place, and it's live, baby.
Democrats, including Governor Roy Cooper, and Republicans, including Speaker Tim Moore and Senate President Phil Berger, supported online betting. Cooper signed it into law last summer in a ceremony at the Charlotte Hornets Arena. As for teams and leagues, they're on board too. Betting, they say, gives fans more of an investment in watching and attending games. Literally, one might say. If you're wondering how much money this entails and where it goes, you've come to the right place. Today, we have a panel of experts here to guide us through the political, commercial, and ethical aspects of sports betting. They are Sean McKeever, who is a philosophy professor at Davidson College, Bill Squadron is an assistant professor of sport management at Elon College, and Brian Murphy is a sports investigative reporter at WRAL in Raleigh. Easy for me to say. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
So for our listeners, if you have a question, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on X, Twitter, at Charlotte Talks. Brian, I want to begin with you. According to the legislators' fiscal research division, over the next 4 years or so, online sports betting will have a net impact of $53 million to $72 million annually. North Carolina's current state budget is $30 billion. With that in mind, why did the governor and the legislature push so hard for this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've explained to everyone that it's sort of a drop in the bucket when you consider the overall budget. I think those numbers are probably low. We'll probably be a little higher than that, but still not difference making in the state budget. I think they pushed for it for several reasons. One, the teams really had a lot of influence on this. The teams were pushing hard for this. They think it's a way to help them compete in a world that's changing very rapidly. Second, I think they saw what was happening in Virginia and Tennessee and the fact that our tax dollars or North Carolina's tax dollars were going across the border to participate in this activity. You know, there were some, Jim Perry, for example, the state senator, said, you know, we shouldn't be telling people, the government shouldn't be in the business of telling people what they can and cannot do with their money. And I think the other thing is that people saw this was happening, not just in Virginia and Tennessee, but offshore accounts were pretty prevalent. And the fact that no one knows where that money's going could have, you know, one of the arguments they used was that it was going to cartels and other trafficking organizations, you know, overseas. These weren't American companies that were regulated by the government in any way.
Bill, you come at this from the sports business side. What flipped the script on gambling in sports after years of leagues refusing to even acknowledge the existence of gambling?
I think it ties into what Brian just said. Even though the 1992 federal law tried to stop sports betting at the Nevada borders, what everyone learned, particularly with the explosion of the internet, is that sports betting was just driven underground, and it had become a huge black market industry with offshore online bookmakers taking lots of money. And so as the years went by, it was very clear that sports betting had not been stopped. It had simply exploded, but in the shadows, where it couldn't be regulated, couldn't be monitored, couldn't be taxed. And I think, and in some ways, an op-ed piece that Adam Silver wrote in 2014 really brought it to light and said, we haven't stopped it. We may as well recognize that sports fans, many of them, like to bet on sports, and they're going to do it. And we're much better off bringing it out into the open, taxing it, regulating it, monitoring it, dealing with addiction, doing it in a proper way, rather than pretending it's not going on.
Adam Silver, by the way, for those who don't know, is the commissioner of the NBA. And Bill, I owe you an apology. It's Elon University, not Elon College, as I mistakenly said. So okay. One other note on that, Bill, what do teams have to gain from this?
There are a number of things that really benefit the league, the teams, and really every sport. The first is engagement. In other words, the more engaged people are, the more they watch on television, the more they go to games, the more they watch the games longer, the more they talk about the games, the greater the engagement, the better the economic opportunity is for a team. So when you think about, you know, building your fan base, obviously you want your fan base to support your team, but there's also an added level of engagement when fans have bet on a team. You may be winning or losing by 30 points, but if your fan, you know, if you are, if there's a segment of fans that has a bet on the game, they're going to keep watching. The other big benefit is sponsorship, because we all know that teams and leagues have as a major revenue category their relationship with sponsors and advertisers and so forth. And by creating an entirely new category, you know, we all know that automotive, insurance, et cetera, are big categories in sports marketing. Now we have another new major category, and that's going to drive revenue to teams and to leagues.
Sean, did you have a thought on that?
Yeah. So from my perspective as a philosopher and ethicist, I would just say we would want to really distinguish two questions here, and one is exactly the ones your guests have already been speaking to, and that's an ethical issue concerning what the legal status of some kind of conduct should be. So with this law, there's questions about, should we try to prevent people from engaging in this activity? And when that is the question, then the issues that have already been raised, well, what good are we going to accomplish if Virginia or Tennessee are already doing this? Or if we try to make it illegal, are we just going to end up promoting black markets? Are extraordinarily relevant to the ethical question of whether we should endeavor to prohibit people from spending their own money in the way they see fit. And people in my line of business would then want to distinguish that question from whether the conduct of betting in your private life should be seen as a ethically or morally defensible action or some kind of vice. And of course, there are many things that we would consider wrong that we choose not to make illegal, because making it illegal just isn't particularly effective.
Sean, I'm curious, you know, you are the outlier here a little bit as a professor of philosophy and an ethicist. How did you come to this topic? Are you a big sports fan, or have you always followed gambling, or just what got you interested in sports betting as it proliferated across the country and into North Carolina?
Well, I definitely come at this from the sports side rather than the gambling side. Mm-hmm. And I teach a course at Davidson College on philosophy of sport, which raises tons of interesting philosophical and ethical issues. And I get to engage with our student athletes. It's a popular course. And I really enjoy thinking about it. So I come at it really as a teacher and as a fan of sports. So I think allowing gambling on sports in the way we are has a chance of transforming sport and having an effect on sport itself. But that's the direction that I come to it from.
One other question, I guess, related to ethics, or at least figuring out how to navigate this. Bill went through the issue of illegal gambling being everywhere. And part of the answer for some is let's legalize it and let's regulate it. So What would you say, Sean, to state lawmakers and other supporters who contend that it's safer if you have it being run by states rather than just kind of the Wild West?
I find that a pretty compelling argument, actually, that bringing it above ground is likely to lead to fewer problems. Again, now that's a partly what we would think of as an empirical or factual question. It's a contested one, and one we need folks to follow and investigate whether legalizing gambling is going to lead to a large rise in the number of gambling, or it's going to lead to a rise in the amount of problem gambling. And I think that's sort of an open question. But in general, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that it's better to have it above ground and regulated than underground.
And if I could add to that, Eric, I mean, I think North Carolina approached this in a very kind of intelligent and methodical way. I mean, the Supreme Court decision that opened the door was nearly 6 years ago. A number of states, in fact, more than half the states in the country have legalized betting. And North Carolina, you know, was able to benefit from the early experiences there, was able to be thoughtful about how it crafted its law. And so I think Governor Cooper and the legislature were wise in taking their time a little bit and learning from other jurisdictions and trying to put together the best possible regulatory regime. And we should bear in mind, by the way, that even with $120 billion bet across the country last year in the states that have legalized, some of the largest states, California, Texas, Florida, are still not legal. So we still don't have full nationwide sports betting.
Brian, let's go through the money and how it is allocated. That's something that I think you've covered pretty closely up there in Raleigh. So we've mentioned a little bit of what the expectations are. Where does the money go once it comes in? And by the way, I should mention, I think it's going to be taxed at a rate of 18%. Is that right?
Yeah, 18%. The original bill had 8%. So, you know, to Bill's point, they improved this legislation. They were going to allow massive deductions for the gambling operators. They really, this legislation improved, I think, you know, empirically. I don't think, you know, that's taking a side to say that this legislation is better for the state than the original legislation was. The first $8.4 million of this is sort of prescribed out. It's allocated already. $2 million goes to the Department of Health and Human Services for gambling addiction treatment and education programs. There's $2 million to two different, or $1 million each to two different youth sports organizations for grants and things like that. Then $300,000 go to each of 13 UNC system athletic departments, not NC State and UNC, but every other one. So we're talking about UNC Pembroke and UNC Asheville, some very tiny ones that really could use the money, all the way up to Appalachian State and Charlotte. And then once you get through the money that's the lottery commission gets $500,000 to run this. Once you get through that, the money that's allocated, the rest of it gets in a big pot. 50% will go to the general fund. 20% will go back to those 13 universities we discussed. And then 30% goes to this newly created major sports event and attraction fund. And that is to help the state try to attract things like a Super Bowl or a NASCAR All-Star race or the NHL All-Star game. Maybe a golf major, maybe a political convention. It's really supposed to bring large scale sporting events or annual events to the state.
We will pick up this conversation. I want to talk a little bit more about that major events fund, among many other subplots, as legalized online sports betting cranks up in North Carolina this week, just in time for March Madness. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation on sports betting in North Carolina. Yesterday marked the start of legalized online sports gambling, just in time for the ACC basketball tournament, which starts today, and the NCAA tournament, which begins next week. Our panel includes Brian Murphy from WRAL, Sean McKeever from Davidson College, and Bill Squadron from Elon University. You had just mentioned this fund, this incentives fund, which I'm interested in my world covering sports business a lot. You always hear cities everywhere, including in North Carolina, saying they need more incentives to bring in these major events. Do we know yet how this will be governed or who will preside over how the money is spent?
I'm sorry, I don't have this information. I think it's the Department of Commerce or one of those that they'll award grants.
That would make.
And so it's based on, you know, you'll have to submit a grant, you know, to try to get one of these events. I just heard that, you know, the NCAA tournament's coming to Raleigh next year for the first and second round. They're bidding again for it, and they have to provide the NCAA with $75,000. So, you know, these organizations have found out that these events are very valuable. And so they are really charging cities to bring them to them. And that's that trade-off between economic development or economic, you know, revenue versus what you got to pay to get these events.
Bill, there's an interesting wrinkle that was added late in the game to the bill that became law. And that is that each betting company, FanDuel or BetMGM or whomever, must be aligned with a team or a league or a venue to be eligible for that license. How does that work? And why do you think it's set up like this?
It's a great question, Eric, because that's actually one of the parts of the North Carolina sports betting law that's somewhat different than most other sports betting laws around the country. That requirement to have a relationship between a sports betting operator, a bookmaker, and a North Carolina sports property, you know, the Panthers, the Hornets, the Hurricanes, et cetera, is not something you see in most of the laws around the country. And I think it was the goal of the legislature to really strengthen the position of those organizations, make it, you know, very clear that while sports betting was going to be legalized, you know, first and foremost, we want to support our local sports organizations, whether it's golf or NASCAR or hockey or basketball or football, et cetera. And so I think the concept, which, you know, it'll be interesting to see if other states pick up on, although it's a little bit more difficult to do it after the fact once you've legalized. But I believe it was done to really support our local sports organizations. And, you know, that was a very interesting wrinkle that was thrown in.
Yeah, it was put in the state budget, like long after the bill had actually passed. Some states do have what they're called tethered licenses, where the licenses are tethered to a sports organization or franchise. But I don't think hardly anybody in the country has every single license tethered to a pro team like we do. What the practical result of that has been is that there are fewer operators in the state today, now that it is launched, than there would have been under the original bill. The original bill allowed for 12 operator licenses that were, you know, some mix of tethered and untethered. This requires that written designation agreement, as you said, and we only have 8 operators. Even though the law allows for up to 13 at the moment, there's only 8. That's really created kind of a limiting effect on the number of operators that can get into the market, because you've got to work through these teams. The Panthers, for example, have not signed a written designation agreement with anybody for market access. And so there's no sports betting organization or operator tied to them at the moment. They do have a marketing agreement with FanDuel, but they do not have the written designation agreement with it.
And do we know what the companies pay to be aligned with the properties?
We don't. Those are third-party contracts that we haven't, you know, gotten details of those agreements. And a lot of them include a lot of marketing and sponsorship. You'll sure. see, if you go to PNC Arena, you'll see it decked out in Fanatics sportsbook signage all over the place now.
Sean, one of the things that's hard to escape, we played that montage at the beginning of the ads, but one of the things that's hard to escape with the ads are the incentives for people to bet. Most of the companies are offering customers credits of $100 or $200 to sign up. And at the same time, they all are at least mentioning limits or tracking in their apps or on their websites to help people know how much time and money they're spending on betting. And my question for you as the resident ethicist and philosopher on the panel is, can these messages coexist coherently?
I think they can. Let's start from the individual view, not the legal point of view, just moral vice. And suppose someone were to think that gambling is a moral vice in some cases. I think the most plausible way to make out that argument is not to say that all gambling is wrong, but the gambling is a kind of risky behavior, and that some people who engage in gambling end up putting themselves in a position where they won't be able to fulfill their other obligations to their kids, to their family, to their spouse, and so on. So that's the first point. The second point is there's a general ethical principle, which is that if it's wrong to do something, it's also wrong to encourage someone else to do that thing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of very general. Now, what are these ads doing? They're encouraging people to gamble. Mm-hmm. Now, if gambling is not always wrong, but it is a ethically risky behavior because you can gamble too much and end up in a position where you can't fulfill your other obligations, then it actually makes sense that if you're going to encourage people to gamble, you also have an obligation to try to encourage them not to gamble too much or in a way that would be ethically compromised. So as long as you think that, of course, if you just thought gambling was always wrong, then it would just be wrong to encourage people to gamble, period.
Eric, you know, Eric, I would jump in and add to what Sean just said by noting that we are very used to that in our society. In other words, we say don't drink and drive, right? We don't say don't drink, right? We have warnings on packs of cigarettes about the dangers to your health. So I think the kind of seemingly cognitive dissonance of, you know, promoting betting, but saying bet responsibly, and here are ways to deal with issues if they arise by calling this hotline or et cetera, I think that's something we as Americans are pretty used to.
That's the voice of Bill Squadron. He is at Elon University. Also with us is Sean McKeever from Davidson College and Brian Murphy from WRAL. Bill, you and I spoke a bit last week about the promotions and the flood of advertising that the onset of legalized betting has brought on. And you told me at the time that this isn't a surprise. For our listeners, why did you expect this, and what does it tell us about how sports betting works?
Well, like with any new market, your best opportunity to get customers is going to be right at the outset. And so sports betting is not really different than any new product market. And when you have major players that want to sign customers and have very experienced and sophisticated marketing techniques, they realize that the opening of something is your best opportunity to sign someone new. And then, of course, if you provide good customer service, hopefully that becomes, you know, a customer with a lengthy lifetime value that justifies, you know, all of the ads we're seeing, which is obviously costing these companies a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But let's bear in mind, I mean, they have enormous experience at this because major states, you know, are all over the country. New York, Michigan, Virginia, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, New Jersey have all had similar launches over the past 5 years. And so they've got a lot of experience knowing that this kind of marketing spend is the best way to attract people in the early stages. And if they provide good service, they believe they'll get a very good return on that investment.
And and I think I may have mentioned this to you previously, it sounds like banking or cable or streaming service, whatever, you know, once you get in as a customer, you're likely to stick around, assuming that you're relatively happy.
I think it's true for the majority of customers. I mean, there will be, I'm sure, a small slice that have multiple accounts and look around for the very best odds for a particular game. But I think the vast majority of bettors will stick with the provider that they start with if they feel they're getting good service. And so I think that's what the betting operators have learned, and they're counting on. That's why they spend so much at the outset in order to try to sign new customers here.
I should have left it at banking. They don't want the cable because the cord cutting is killing the cable. But anyway, Brian, critics have pointed to the lottery. By the way, the Lottery Commission is the governing body of online sports betting. But they've pointed to the lottery and said, we were promised bountiful education funding from lottery proceeds. and yet school systems remain woefully underfunded. So why will this be different, meaning sports betting and how it helps the state? Governor Cooper, for example, has said he wants much of the funding that goes to the general fund to be put toward education. What's the answer to that question? Is there an answer to that question yet?
There's not a great answer to that question. And the echoes of that lottery fight, which were, you know, about 20 years ago, really showed themselves during this sports gambling fight. You know, a lot of the critics, or at least some people in the legislature, were there for the lottery fights and said, we were promised, you know, this money wouldn't supplant, you know, money from the legislature. And in fact, it has. I think the best argument Jason Sain made this to me is that, you know, it's despite everybody that hates the lottery, no one has ever put forth a bill to repeal the lottery because they'd have no way to replace all the money that comes from the lottery. And I think you're going to see something similar to this. Even if people don't like it, there's $100 million, maybe $75 million of tax revenue that's going to come in and be distributed to various places. And no one is going to write a bill that gets rid of that. And so, I, you know, the one important point is that the future legislatures are not obligated to spend the money in this exact way. You know, you can't tie the hands of future lawmakers. And so they could decide in 5 years, in 10 years to spend the money in an entirely different manner.
I should mention, I was looking last night on the NC Department of Public Instruction website, because that's just what I do. It's my hobby. But 30% of lottery revenue goes to education. Even if you put 100% of the lottery revenue toward education, it would fund 19% of the K-12 budget. So that's according to the State Department of Public Instruction. Brian, I want to get your thoughts on what Mecklenburg Democrat John Autry, who helped kill gambling legislation in 2022 before it passed last year, told me during a recent interview. Here is John Autry assessing the risk and reward from sports betting.
There's gambling going on, but I don't think the state should be sanctioning it, especially when it's only going to amount to about 2% of the state budget anyway. It seems like the most regressive sort of taxing to cover the state budget that hurts some of the people that are the most vulnerable.
He also spoke about possible gambling expansion beyond online sports betting.
These schemes to fund state services have proven to fall short in some of the early adopting states. I mean, yes, you've got revenue that's coming in for a couple of years, but it tends to fall off after a couple of years and never really recovers to that same level again.
And finally, Autry offers his opinion on the state share.
I think the citizenry would be very surprised to see how much money the company makes compared to how much they actually contribute to North Carolina. It's chicken feed. Now, is that a red chicken or a white chicken? And what are the odds on it being a red? I mean, you know, what color Gatorade is the coach going to be doused with? I mean, it's really pitiful.
So, Brian, how common are those views we just heard from Representative Autry? And do you think there are valid rebuttals to what he's saying?
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly able to help kill the bill in 2022, and he had stripped college sports gambling out of it by citing the Dixie Classic scandal in the 1960s. The counter to that argument is that, and we're seeing it already, when gambling is regulated, red flags go up almost immediately when there's unusual betting patterns on individual games or individual sports. And so, you know, the sports will argue that there's better integrity when we know where the bets are coming from and we see unusual placement of bets. In fact, this happened with a recent basketball game involving Temple. They saw an unusual betting pattern. Some of the markets actually stopped taking bets on that game, and they flagged, you know, regulators and others to let them know about it. I don't disagree with him in the sense that this is not a large portion of the state budget. And, you know, you're exposing an entire population to gambling just to get a small portion of the state budget. That's a legitimate criticism and one that was hashed out in the legislature. I would mention the next thing is that many, many people see sports gambling as just an entree, a foot in the door to a much larger gambling through either iGaming, which is basically full casinos on your phone, or video lottery terminals, or which are basically slot machines. And those produce way more income for the state. And so many people see this as a way of getting gambling in the door to then expand gambling to help pay for other things in the state budget. So that will be the next fight, I assume.
Sean.
Yeah, I just wanted to build on what Brian just said and also circle back to where we started. There may be a regressive aspect to raising revenue in this way, but I would say it's even more regressive to have the revenue raised and sent to Virginia or Tennessee, where it doesn't benefit at all the people who are providing the revenue. So I think this falls under the heading of that collective action problem that we kind of started out with. If other people are doing it already, then it's hard to make the case against us doing it.
Bill?
Yeah, and I would just add that I think he's certainly entitled to believe betting is wrong and shouldn't do it. But I think as we learned in Prohibition, there are a lot of people who like doing things, other people who oppose it. If you drive it underground, it's going to happen. You know, Brian mentioned this issue of integrity. I mean, we've had histories of scandals in sports when sports betting was happening illegally with illegal bookmakers. So it's not as though this risk is suddenly emerging or being created because sports betting is being legalized. All it's potentially doing is giving us a better handle and ability to address it, to see it and address it.
So the one argument against the regressive nature is that sports gambling does tend to attract a different audience than, say, the lottery. The lottery, you can buy a ticket for $1 or $2 and hope to win hundreds of millions of dollars. Largely in sports gambling, and this is changing somewhat, you have to bet $10 to win $10 or $100 to win $100. There's not a jackpot element to it. Now, certainly the operators have tried with these single game parlays and other parlays to increase kind of this lottery aspect of sports gambling, but largely it is not put in $1, win $1 billion. It is, you have to bet what you win.
Got it. We have much more to get into with sports betting coming to North Carolina. Actually, it's already here as of yesterday, and March Madness not far behind. No coincidence there. Stay with us for more on sports betting in North Carolina right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and today we're exploring the new world of legalized online sports betting in North Carolina, which started this week. My guests are Sean McKeever. He's a professor of philosophy and ethics at Davidson College. Bill Squadron is an assistant professor of sport management at Elon University, and Brian Murphy is WRAL's sports investigative reporter. Bill, I want to ask you, what motivate, we're talking a little bit about regulation of gambling and how that in many ways can help. What motivates teams and online betting operators to try to prevent addiction? Do you think their efforts are sincere?
I do. Obviously, they believe this is a big new business opportunity, and so we can't be naive about that. They are excited about this. They see additional revenue coming from different kinds of directions as a result of it, as we talked about earlier, engagement, sponsorship, et cetera. On the other hand, there are many, many people who are concerned that the legalization will lead to greater addiction. As we've talked about, it's not as though betting hasn't been going on. It's not as though gambling addiction hasn't been going on. But it is certainly very possible that by having greater marketing, greater access to it, being legal, we are going to see a rise in problem gambling. It's really incumbent on the betting operators and others involved to address this openly, honestly, and effectively, because it's not in anyone's interest for that to become a, you know, growing and serious problem, because that will backfire on all of us. People will respond to that by probably enacting newer and more restrictive regulations. So I actually believe it's in the interests of betting operators and other stakeholders to be genuinely responsive to this problem, because it's in their interest for it not to get out of hand.
Sean, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the same question.
Well, I think it's a serious, a very serious issue. It's one on which I think the major questions are not philosophical, but factual, namely, how much of an increase in problem gambling is going to be occasioned by the increased marketing. I mean, we know that people who run gambling businesses are very adept at attracting repeat customers. They're very skilled. They study human psychology. They get data, and they are very, very good at it. So I think those who are concerned are very right to be concerned. At the same time, being concerned isn't the same thing as knowing for certain how much of an increase in problem gambling there's really going to be. I think one place where there's likely to be a misalignment of interest. So if a certain cut of the money is going to go to gambling treatment programs, then if you have a serious problem gambler, I don't doubt that the business would like to send that money to effective treatment programs. Mm-hmm. But people don't become problem gamblers in an instant. It happens gradually over time. Mm-hmm. And so when that intervention is going to occur might be when, from the perspective of the business, they're thinking, we've got a great customer. Mm-hmm. We don't want to tap the brakes quite yet. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone in public health or someone who really works with people with gambling addiction might say, no, you really need to catch this early. So the interest may not align. But again, this is a factual question that we just need to keep our eye on and do the best we can.
Brian, as you know, North Carolina approved in-person sports betting several years ago at the state's tribal casinos. There are two Harrah's Cherokee casinos, and there's a temporary one operated by the Catawbas in Kings Mountain, not far from Charlotte. What has been the response to those, and any idea how those sports betting sites have fared?
Well, certainly the casinos on the Cherokee tribal land were mentioned repeatedly throughout the debate in the legislature as transforming what's happened up on the boundary there in far western North Carolina. Those are actually closer to maybe Atlanta than they are to Raleigh. And so they are attracting a different audience. I have been to the Catawba one, and they certainly put out a lot of press releases about the money they're donating back to the surrounding community. The largest problem there is they haven't built sort of the facility that they plan to build, a large hotel, a large casino. Right now, they're basically operating out of trailers. And so the experience, I don't think, is what they hope it will be eventually. And certainly, I think that the casinos that have appeared on the Virginia board with North Carolina, the one in Danville in particular, have really, which is much closer to Greensboro and Raleigh than it is to the population centers of Virginia. So you're seeing that these borders don't really matter when it comes to these gaming possibilities. I think no doubt those in-person casinos sort of influence this debate. I mean, it's hard when you have something like that in your state and you can point to it and say, look, there hasn't been any problems. There hasn't been an increase in crime. In fact, the Cherokee have benefited greatly from this. That was certainly used as a line of rationale for supporters of sports betting who said, we haven't seen the problems that you're talking about. And in fact, we've seen benefits.
Bill, do you think that this is, when I say this, the concern about addiction, do you think the concern is heavier for online sports betting because of simple math? Everyone has a phone in their hands. They can do it anytime they want. Whereas to go to a sports book, you have to get in your car and actually go there.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes it easier for everyone. And that definitely contributes to the potential risk. But that is the world we live in now. I mean, in fact, it's great that people may have the option to do something in person. That may be a nice experience for people. I think it's probably a pretty good business for those that operate those physical locations. But the fact is, the vast, vast majority of betting, as the vast majority of commerce today, is taking place online or on your phone. And that is just the world we live in. I mean, when New York went from moving from having several physical locations to making it available online and mobile, from 1 month to the next, it went from under $50 million being bet to over $1 billion being bet. So, I mean, the level of magnitude between the physical locations, which are fine, and what happens online is, you know, night and day. And you're right. I mean, it may, by having it so easy and at your fingertips, it potentially can cause other problems. And as Sean said, I mean, a lot of this is going to be dependent on doing research, gathering data, understanding where issues arise, and hopefully responding to it when we see it.
That's the voice of Bill Squadron. He is a professor at Elon University. Also with us is Brian Murphy from WRAL and Sean McKeever from Davidson College. Sean, I want to ask you, you and Bill are both obviously on college campuses a lot. And we know, or researchers know, that young males, particularly college age males, tend to be most vulnerable to sports betting problems. The minimum age is 21. I'm not sure. I guess we don't know until this week how effective that is managed. But what do you think colleges and universities should be doing to prepare themselves for potential problems?
Well, I think the natural thing for us to do is just to fold it into the broader life educational programs that are run on college campuses like my own and like Bill's. We have programs that encourage people to drink alcohol responsibly, to take care with sexual relationships, and so on. And to the extent that this is a risky and relevant kind of behavior, then some type of education should just be folded into the way we handle other similar issues for our students.
Yeah.
Bill, you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that we as a, you know, university environment, dealing with potential health and other issues for students, this, you know, should have been on everyone's radar screen even before sports betting became legal, because as we talked about earlier, there were, you know, there were online offshore opportunities that I'm sure students took advantage of, including students under 21 before that. And we, as an ecosystem that wants to support them, should have been aware of this as a potential problem. But I agree completely with Sean that now that it's legal and visible and you're going to see ads everywhere, we should be incorporating that messaging to students that A, it's not legal until you're 21, B, you shouldn't be getting somebody who is 21 to make bets for you, and C, there are numerous risk factors here to be aware of, and you really need to be careful if this is something you have any interest in.
Brian, we were talking earlier about in-person versus the online sports betting that just started. When this legislation was in its earlier stages, a lot of the teams were talking about putting a sports book on their property, and they can do that. That's part of the legislation. Fanatics and the Carolina Hurricanes in your neighborhood seem to be really interested in doing that. The Charlotte Hornets and Carolina Panthers have been a little quieter. And then there's some other properties that we just haven't heard from. So I'm curious, do you think there's any diminishment in sports books popping up on those facilities, or what's your sense of where that may be going?
Well, the Lottery Commission said that only one operator has actually approached them about the possibility of putting in that sports book, and that is Fanatics here in Raleigh. I think, as Bill mentioned, the vast majority of the spending comes from the mobile devices. You're talking well over 95%, probably closer to 98% of the total revenue comes from mobile gambling. And so it really isn't in the operator's interest to create another location where you can do this. Now, the teams, on the other hand, do want that. They want activation on their sites for more than just game days. And certainly you can see the benefits of having a nice sports bar, sports book kind of setting to bring people over. However, I don't think people, even if you go to that, I think you're just going to bet on your phone where you can get bonuses and loyalty points or whatever, you know, whatever you would get. So there may be kiosks that pop up in various locations, various sporting events, sports arenas, but I just don't think that putting up these physical sports books is going to be a large priority for anybody.
How much talk was there during the debates about prop bets? You know, there's the all the silly bets John Autry, Representative Autry, made reference to that. Are we going to bet on the color of the Gatorade and those kinds of things? Was there any any sort of dissection or consideration of those? And I'm not even sure if a state can limit those.
Well, Ohio just limited, you can no longer put prop bets on college games. Okay. And that has been a big issue. It's popped up in several states where, hey, I bet on RJ Davis to pick on the ACC player of the year to score at least 20 points in this game, but he only had 19 and he missed a free throw at the end. And then there are around people on these college campuses that probably bet on that. And so there's been some reports of some harassment of college athletes because they didn't make a prop or something like that. So the props are allowed in North Carolina. That's one of the betting categories that is allowed. However, I do think we may see at some point some fine tuning of that, particularly as it relates to college athletes. We've seen it in Ohio. We've seen other states discuss that.
Go ahead, Bill.
Sorry, just to add, Eric, that regulators in the states can control what bets are permitted. In North Carolina, as Brian said, I mean, prop bets are for the most part allowed. You can't bet on things like injuries, right, or foul or penalty calls. So there's a few small areas where they've limited it. But I think, it's a great point about Ohio. I think prop bets have potential for raising just concerns among the public. And, it is an area where, going back to what Sean said, we want to look at it carefully. We want to study this. And it may well be that that's an area that does benefit from increased regulation down the road, depending on what the data show.
Bill, I'm curious, because you follow this closely, obviously. I think most sports fans know that in the UK and in England, particularly in London, you can't go 4 feet without falling upon the opportunity to bet on sports, especially soccer, their football. Is there anything to be learned from how the UK does this?
Yeah, I mean, we should be looking very carefully because that's a very mature market. It's been multiple decades. It's successful in the sense that it's a sort of accepted part of their society. But their regulatory approach is very engaged, and they are constantly tweaking the rules. To give you one example, the rules about marketing, when you can advertise, what time of day. Clearly, they are very strict about any kind of marketing they believe is geared toward children and adolescents. So I believe that that's one of the jurisdictions, maybe the prime one, that we can learn a great deal from. And to give you an example about prop bets, my understanding, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, is that you used to be able to do a prop bet there on who would have the first throw in at a soccer game. And after somebody took the opening kick and kicked it about 2 miles out of bounds, they eliminated that prop bet. So I think it's not a bad lesson to learn from.
Brian, as we're talking about, Sean McKeever and Bill Squadron are saying, we need to track this closely. We need to have the information. How much information are we going to get? Do we have an idea of what exactly is going to be shared with the public?
Yeah, on the 20th of each month, the operators are going to have to file their revenue forms, tax information with the lottery commission. And so we're going to find out, which operator has the largest market share. We may even find out things such as which sport is being bet on the most. I think that GeoComply, which is one of these organizations that tracks where logins come from, will have some information as soon as this week about the sheer number of attempted logins or attempted account access from the state of North Carolina. So I think data, if anything that these gambling companies are great at, it's collecting lots and lots of data. We'll see how much of that they're willing to share with the public, but there will be reams and reams of data available.
And the confidence level, I assume they wouldn't be out here with this if they weren't confident that age and geofencing will work.
Right. And geofencing has worked. I mean, if you tried to log in to a Virginia account from North Carolina, you clearly saw that you were unable to do that. So I think geofencing does work.
That will have to be the last word. It comes from Brian Murphy from WRAL. My thanks also to Sean McKeever from Davidson College and Bill Squadron from Elon University. As you can see, we've got a lot of sports betting in our future, whether you engage or not, or just stick to your office pool. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for joining us today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.